Night for your amazing grace that has saved us, washed us, bought us, convicted us, quickened us, redeemed us, and brought us together as a body. And Lord, will one day glorify us as we gather together in your presence. Even so, come quickly, Lord Jesus. Amen. Amen. In your Bibles this evening, if you would, the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 14. The book of 1 Samuel, chapter number 14. I want to take just a moment, because it's been a couple of weeks, I'd like to take just a moment before we read the text tonight, to refamiliarize ourselves with where we are in the narrative itself. If you will remember, one of the primary duties of Israel's first king was to go to war with Israel's enemies. In particular, Saul had been commissioned by God to battle the Philistines. The Philistines had been an oppressive people. They had possessed a great deal of the Israeli territory. If you can remember, the Israeli men, the soldiers even, weren't even allowed to own a sword or spear. They were really under the thumb of the Philistine Empire. And so God had told Saul through Samuel that one of your first responsibilities is to free my people from the bondage of the Philistines. Yet we found out that in this last chapter that Saul had been king for some 2 years and really hadn't done a thing to free Israel from the bondage of that Gentile nation. And so it seems like Saul's never really going to get anything done. And in walks a young man by the name of Jonathan. Jonathan was Saul's son. And if you will remember, Jonathan gets the proverbial ball rolling. He goes out to battle the Philistines. He goes up against a garrison of the Philistines, and he kills them all. The Philistines respond to that by gathering together a huge army. And if you think about it, perhaps the Philistines, they want to squash this rebellion early on. Yeah, Israel now has their own king, but they're still under our control. They're just a vassal state, really. And so the Philistines gather up this vast army, huge cavalry. They have chariots. And if you remember, the text said that they had soldiers that you couldn't even number them. They were like the sand of the sea. That's how many Philistine soldiers had gathered together against Israel. Well, what happens? Saul's army flees when they see this vast Philistine army surrounding them, coming up against them. Saul's army tucks tail and runs and leaves Saul. In fact, at chapter 13, it says in verse 15 that there were only Saul and about 600 men left. Earlier he had had a couple hundred thousand. Now he only has some 600 men there with him. But again, in an act of courageous faith, with Saul's army either deserting or frozen, in walks Jonathan again. Here comes Jonathan again. He is, to some extent, showing far more bravery and courage than the king is, the king's son. And he goes to battle against another Philistine garrison. And we learn in this chapter those beautiful words in verse number 6, chapter 14, verse 6, that this armor bearer says, and Jonathan, they are discussing this, that the Lord will work for us, for there's no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. And so Jonathan and his armor bearer climb up this rock face, go to battle against the garrison, the second garrison of Philistines. And the text says that he killed about 20 men in the space of about a half an acre lot. And folks, that's a pretty bloody battle. And that's not probably not somebody, you know, Jonathan, again, I emphasize, he's probably still a young guy, age 15, maybe 20 years old, but he's probably not somebody you'd want to cross. He can kill 20 Philistine soldiers with a sword and having his armor bearer behind him. Obviously a man who was equipped for battle. And so what is going on? And if you will remember, we found down through verses number 15, 16, that God sends this cloud of confusion over the Philistine army. The earth shakes, there's vast confusion, fear, trembling, and the Philistine army actually begin to attack themselves, itself. The soldiers fall on one another and begin killing one another. And if you would, look at verse 15, chapter 14, verse 15, and there was trembling in the host in the field and among all the people, the garrison and the spoilers, they also trembled in the earthquake. So it was a very great trembling. And Saul's trying to figure out what's going on, because if you will remember, and this is important because it'll play into tonight, Jonathan didn't tell his daddy where he was going or what he was doing. Jonathan just left. And he went and picked this fight with the Philistines. And so Saul says, what is going on? Let's find out who's left. And he finds out his son, Jonathan, and his armor bearer have left. And because of this confusion and fear, the Israeli army rallies behind Saul. And Saul goes out to battle against the Philistines. And in fact, you see verse 20, and Saul and all the people that were with him assembled themselves, and they came to the battle. And behold, every man's sword was against his fellow. The Philistines are fighting themselves. And there was a very great discomfiture. And then it says, verse 21, moreover, the Hebrews that were with the Philistines before that time, that went up with him into the camp from the country round about, even they also turned to be with the Israelites that were with Saul and Jonathan. So even some of those that had deserted to the Philistine army are now fighting with the Israelis. And then in verse 22, even the men that had run and hid joined the army, joined the battle, I should say. And so verse 23 is a key point, and that's where we finished up a couple of weeks ago. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over unto Beth-Aven. So here is Saul reluctantly taking his army to battle against the Philistines, but God granting a great victory that day. And that's where we are in the narrative. So let's pick up right here and let's read just a little bit. We're not going to finish the whole of this chapter, but we'll get the bulk of the narrative that is in front of us. Verse 24, and the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I may be avenged on mine enemies. So none of the people tasted any food. And all they of the land came to a wood, and there was honey upon the ground. And when the people were come into the wood, behold, the honey dropped. But no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan heard not when his father charged the people with the oath. Wherefore he put forth the end of the rod that was in his hand, and dipped it in a honeycomb, and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes were enlightened. Then answered one of the people and said, thy father straightly charged the people with an oath, saying, cursed be the man that eateth any food this day. And the people were faint. Then said Jonathan, my father hath troubled the land. See, I pray you, how mine eyes have been enlightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more, if haply the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found. For there had not been now a much, for had there not been now a much greater slaughter among the Philistines? And they smote the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, and the people were very faint. And the people flew upon the spoil, and took sheep and oxen and calves, and slew them on the ground, and the people did eat them with the blood. Then they told Saul, saying, behold, the people sin against the Lord, and that they eat with the blood. And he said, ye have transgressed roll a great stone unto me this day. And Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people and say unto them, bring me hither every man his ox and every man his sheep, and slay them here and eat, and sin not against the Lord in eating with the blood. And all the people brought every man his ox with him that night and slew them there. And Saul built an altar unto the Lord. The same was the first altar that he built unto the Lord. And Saul said, let us go down after the Philistines by night and spoil them until the morning light. And let us not leave a man of them. And they said, do whatsoever seemeth good unto thee. Then said the priest, let us draw near hither unto God. And Saul asked counsel of God, shall I go down after the Philistines without delivering them into the hand of Israel? But he answered him not that day. Now we're going to stop there, and if I don't forget, we'll pick back up there in a few minutes with our reading. I would like for you to hang your thoughts on this title, Saul's Selfish, Silly Oath. Saul's Selfish, Silly Oath. One of my favorite movies of all time is an old John Wayne movie, a Western, called The Searchers. And if you don't know that movie, you just need to get right with Jesus. That's all I can tell you. Every good Christian likes John Wayne, right? But in the movie, the Indians attack a number of homesteads and kill the ranchers and their families. So John Wayne and a couple of other men ride out to investigate what has happened and even, if possible, to try to retaliate against the Indians. However, when they arrive, they soon discover that the attack on those nearby homesteads was just a diversion. It was a tactic by the Indians to get them out away from their own home so that while they were gone, they could attack the home or family of John Wayne, the character here in the movie. And so they are tempted to turn right around and ride back. If you know the movie, you remember this. They want to turn right around and ride back to try to save their families and prevent the Indians from killing all of their family. But as frustrating as it is, they have to stop and let the horses rest. They've got to give them food and water and rest. They've already ridden many, many miles out here, and now they got to turn around and ride back. But one young man, a man by the name of Marty in the movie, this bull-headed man, a young man, he refuses to stop to water and rest his horse. And instead, he lashes his horse, pulls out his whip, and tears out wide open to try to get back to the homestead before it's too late. However, his impetuous decision did not work at all. If you are familiar with the movie, you'll remember that Marty rode his horse literally to death. He not only did he not get back in time, his foolish decision ended up costing him dearly. A couple of hours later, there comes John Wayne and the rest of the party, and they ride past this young man as he's carrying his saddle with many, many miles still left to go. This young man's hasty behavior was foolhardy and costly. Not only did his decision not help, it actually hurt their case. And his obstinate choice not to rest, feed, and water his horse cost him his only mode of transportation. Now, we're living in a world where we have cars and you jump in them and we just go, right? But if you step back into an earlier world when a horse was the only means of transportation, an animal, to kill your horse by riding it to death would be essentially like driving your car without oil in the engine and just blowing it up. And this is exactly what he did. Now, I realize that that is only a movie, but it serves to illustrate exactly what we find in the narrative before us this evening. Like the young man in this Hollywood movie, Saul makes a foolish, stubborn decision which led not to the death of an animal, but to the near death of his own son. And worse than that, his stubborn, foolish decision, this oath that Saul made, caused the people, the soldiers in particular, the men of Israel, to commit an egregious sin in the sight of God. Decisions, and especially those made by leaders of men, should be made with reasoned thought and prayer rather than hot tempers and overinflated egos. Passion is no substitute for wisdom. And in the passage we have tonight, we see Saul's ego swollen up. We see his arrogance, his impetuous nature. We see his selfishness. We see his arrogance. We see a man who is not leading the nation humbly and meekly, depending on the sound wisdom and counsel of God. He makes a foolhardy decision, a silly and selfish oath which cost him and Israel dearly. Let's look at this, try to unpack what we have before us in this narrative here tonight. In fact, if you're in the habit of marking things in your Bible, you might notice there is an intentional contrast made between verse 23 and verse 24. The very language that's right here, it makes it evident that the writer wants us to see the faithfulness of God and the foolishness of Saul. Look at verse 23. So the Lord saved Israel that day. Then verse 24, and the men of Israel were distressed that day. Do you see that contrast there? God saved Israel, but there's a problem. The problem is the people were distressed that day. They were overwhelmed that day. And we don't have to read far to wonder why. Because the sentence tells us, for, here's why. Here's why the men were distressed that day. Even though God had delivered them, it was God that brought confusion to the camp of the Philistines. It was God that caused them to turn on one another. And that vast army that was more than you could count as the sand of the sea, it was God that sent in that strong delusion that caused them to kill one another. But even in spite of that, the men of Israel were not celebrating their victory. They were in a dire straits. And why? Verse 24 says, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening. Now notice this language. That I may be avenged on mine enemies. Well, how did they just become your enemies all of a sudden, Saul? You know, you've been king for 2 years and hadn't done anything about your enemies. They didn't seem to be bothering you all that much until Jonathan went and poked a bear, and now that they're awake and now they're ready to attack, all of a sudden you want to say, nobody can eat a bite until we win this thing. No one is allowed to eat any food, not to have anything, until my ego is satisfied. That's really what it's about. Until I am avenged of my enemies. And what happened? The close of verse 24. So none of the people tasted any food. So just try to get this picture in your mind. Think on this. Huge cavalry. Huge Philistine cavalry. I don't remember the exact number of chariots that they had. Large number of chariots. Let's see. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand of the sea. So here's this vast Philistine army. And you got to provide for that army. So you got to bring provisions for that army, right? You got to bring food and bread and animals to slaughter to kill them. You have water for them. You got to have all of that for that army. Well, they're killing each other. The Philistine army is all killing each other, warring against one another. Israel is just sort of letting that happen until it seems like the vast majority of the Philistine army is now dead, and they begin to flee. Now Saul and his little bunch, ragtag bunch, and those that have joined him are now in the chase, and so is Jonathan. He's now rejoined his father. They're in the chase, and it would be normal that you would fall on the spoil. There would be thousands and thousands of Philistine tents with armor and weaponry and food. They would have stores of provisions. They would have animals. They would have all these things that if you've been a soldier and you've been at war all day, you'd probably be happy to have a little something in your belly. And that would have been the normal course of warfare. What would normally have been done? You go to war, you win, you take the spoils. But to feed Saul's inflated ego, he says, no one is allowed to eat a bite. I guess maybe he thought if we fast, God will give us a victory. That's just me trying to be generous to Saul. Saul gets, and the more I study him, the more religious he gets. I don't mean the more godlike, the more religious he gets when it's convenient for him. But Saul here, to feed his ego, says none of the spoil can be enjoyed. And so the people, in their chase of the enemy, we see in verse 25, they come to a patch of woods, and there was honey on the ground. Verse 26 says, when the people were coming to the wood, behold, the honey dropped. Now that shouldn't surprise us, should it? Because God had long promised Israel to give them a land that flowed with milk and honey, right? And here it is. That's exactly what we see here. God has provided this gracious gift to his nation, but in particular, right now, it'd be nice to have a little something to eat. And I'm going to say this with some sarcasm, but you get it. I would imagine their blood sugar was running low. Might have been some diabetics among the army, right? And there's this honey dripping down off the trees. And all you got to do is just get you a handful of it and eat. And that's exactly what Jonathan does. You remember, Jonathan had left early that morning to go start this fight with the Philistines. He'd went out and attacked the garrison, so he wasn't there when his dad said, nobody can eat anything. When he went in and made this silly oath that he made, Jonathan wasn't there. He's already gone to battle while his daddy's, you know, feeding his ego. So the people, as they're making their way through this, you know their mouth was watering. You know they were tired. As a matter of fact, we'll find out here a little bit later that they travel some 15 to 20 miles by foot in pursuit of an enemy. Now, after 15 to 20 miles of being on foot, fighting, stopping, killing enemies, then chasing some more, fighting, stopping, killing, you're going to get hungry. You're going to get tired. You're going to get thirsty. You're going to get weary. Your body needs caloric intake. It's just a fact. You don't need the caloric intake. I give it, but the human body needs caloric intake, right? You with me? It just needs that in order to strengthen itself. But to feed Saul's ego, no, nobody can eat until I'm avenged of my enemies. But do you notice verse 27 as we read that? But Jonathan heard not when his father charged the people with the oath. Wherefore, old Jonathan just took the rod that was in his hand, stuck it down there, got him a big old handful of honey, and ate it. And what did it do? It strengthened him. In fact, the language here is, in the close of verse 27, his eyes were enlightened. And that's just a simple way of saying it refreshed him, it renewed him. That sugar hit his system and he's ready to go run some more, right? And so you'd think that's a good thing, right? But it's not a good thing because the king, his father, had made this silly oath. In verse 28, they tell Jonathan, your father has straitly charged the people with an oath saying, cursed be the man that eateth any food this day. And because of this, verse 28, the close of it says, the people were faint. And Jonathan, and this would be abnormal. Jonathan says in verse 29, my dad made a dumb decision. Now, you didn't openly rebuke the king and his decisions. I don't care if you are the prince. Even if you are the king's son, you don't question the king's judgment. But he does so here because it is such an open and clear bad decision. Verse 29, my father has troubled the land. If I were to put that in some middle Georgia vernacular, daddy did a dumb thing. That was a dumb thing for him to do. How does he expect his men, how does he expect his soldiers to run and fight his enemies without any food, without any sustenance, without any anything to strengthen them? And he says to them, listen, look how my eyes have been opened up, how much stronger I am because I tasted a little bit of this honey. Verse 30, how much more? How much more we would have defeated the enemy, how much stronger would we be, how much more able for battle if we'd have been able to fall on the spoil? That's what he says in verse 30. How much more if happily the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found? If they'd have been given time to stop and eat and renew their strength, we would actually be in better military position than we are now. Because right now the army is faint. We just better hope them Philistines don't turn around and start attacking us because we're all weak. It's almost like that illustration that I gave. Listen, I know that this guy in the movie that I used, that he wanted to get home and try to save his family, but his impetuous decision not to stop and rest his horse ended him riding that horse to death. It cost him. If he would have stopped, give the horse food, water, time to rest, he could have ridden that horse all the way back and he wouldn't have had to go buy another one, which is what he did in the movie. And in this case, if they would have stopped long enough to resupply, how about this? To get some weaponry from the fallen Philistine soldiers. To get maybe a shield or a sword or a spear. Or to get some of the food that they had been eating. If they had done that, they would have been in better military position. And that's exactly what he is saying there. You not see that at close of verse 30? For had there not been now a much greater slaughter among the Philistines? If the army had been allowed to enjoy the spoil, you know, we'd have killed even more of them. And so in verse 31, it says that they smote the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, which is, as I said, some 15 to 20 miles. And notice again, the close of verse 31, and the people were very faint. Why? Because Saul had made this silly and selfish oath that served no practical purpose at all other than to feed his own inflated ego. It was not smart militarily. It was not smart practically. All it was to feed his ego. So when evening comes and the oath is lifted, because the command was throughout this day, nobody can eat anything. And if you know your Jewish calendar, when does the day begin? The day begins in the evening. At 6 o'clock in the evening begins a new day. I don't guess they had daylight saving time like us crazy Americans do. But 6 o'clock in the evening begins a new day. So that night, after they've been running all day, they are so hungry. What do, the soldiers? Verse 32, the people flew upon the spoil, and they take sheep, oxen, calves, slew them on the ground, and the people did eat the animals, eat them with the blood. So that's a little bit difficult, but it's not. It would have been normal Jewish custom for them to drain all the blood out of an animal before cutting it up and cooking it. That would have been normal Jewish custom. But apparently what they do here is they kill the animal, don't drain the blood out of it, and maybe even, depending on how you read this, cut the animals up and begin to eat the meat raw and uncooked. This was an egregious sin before God. God had commanded that the people were not to eat the blood. Now, I don't want to get into a long debate about this. There are some of you here who do not appreciate the splendor of a half-cooked ribeye steak. Rare, maybe medium rare. But whatever that is the case, and it's not blood you're eating anyway, but that's another story. The Jews were forbidden from eating the blood. In fact, I'd like you to turn back to Leviticus chapter 17, and I want you to see this. I want you to see this for yourself, Leviticus 17. So you might think, whose fault is this? Who's to be blamed for them falling on these animals and at the very least not draining the blood from them, if not altogether just eating raw meat? Who's to blame? Well, Saul figures the people are to blame, but I'm more of the position that Saul's to blame for it because he's the one who made this silly law. Look at Leviticus 17. This is what God says. Verse 10. And whatsoever man there be of the house of Israel or of the strangers that sojourn among you that eateth any manner of blood, I will even set my face against that soul that eateth blood and will cut him off from among the people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I've given it to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that maketh an atonement for the soul. Therefore I said unto the children of Israel, no soul of you shall eat blood, neither shall any stranger that sojourneth among you eat blood. And whatsoever man there be of the children of Israel, of the strangers that sojourn among you, which hunteth and catcheth any beast or fowl that may be eaten, he shall even pour out the blood thereof and cover it with dust. For it is the life of all flesh. The blood of it is the life, is for the life thereof. Therefore, I said unto the children of Israel, ye shall eat the blood of no manner of flesh, for the life of all flesh is the blood thereof. Whosoever eateth it shall be cut off. Now that, folks, is just as plain can be. So what had the Israeli soldiers done? In their desperate weakness from fighting and battling and running all day, when they finally get the opportunity to eat, they disregard the civil law in Israel and they fall on these animals and eat them without, at the very least, without draining the blood. This is an egregious sin. It was wrong. God commanded this is not to be done. So who's to blame? You want to blame the soldiers for this? Listen, they were hungry. They were famished. They've been running, you know, all day long. I don't think it's right to blame them for this. I think the blame falls squarely on the shoulders of the king. Saul is to be blamed for this. For this silly, selfish oath that he put on his people. I mean, listen, have you ever worked for someone who didn't have a clue as to what they were doing? Do you know what I'm talking about? Listen, I worked at the post office. I can write books on this stuff. If you don't know what you're doing, they'll promote you at the post office. I guarantee you that. Now, I say that with some measure of sarcasm, you know that? But it's like, look, we want to promote them, get them out of here, so... But you ever work with somebody and you look at them making decisions and you think they don't have a clue what they're doing? Jonathan obviously felt a lot that way concerning his father. How silly, how absurd to put your soldiers under a fast while they're trying to fight your war. That's absurd. And so the people, they fall on the spoil, they eat the blood, and finally Saul finds out about it, verse 33. And this is what is interesting to me, verse 33. Then they told Saul, saying, behold, the people sin against the Lord, and that they eat with the blood. And he said, ye have transgressed. Old finger pointing Saul there, huh? Y'all have messed up here. And, you know, if you're one of them, you're biting your tongue, right? Just like when you work for somebody who don't know what they're doing and you see them make a silly decision and you have to bite your tongue to keep from saying that's a dumb thing to do. There's probably a whole bunch of people standing around the camp there biting their tongue saying, well, King, it was your fault that this happened. And so he says, bring a great stone to me. So he then does the right thing. We'll give Saul some credit. He stops them. And of course, they'd have never been in that position if it weren't for him. But he sets a big stone up and then he sends word throughout the whole camp. Stop doing this. Bring your animals. And so he sets his stone up, properly kills the animals, bleeds them out, and then gives it to them so that they can go back and cook the meat as they're supposed to and then eat. And that's what happens there in verse 34. And then in verse 35, Saul builds an altar. A lot could be said about that. Again, I think it is just him. I think he's just trying to curry favor with God, really. I think is what it is. It was like in the past where Israel has taken the ark into battle with them as if it was like a lucky rabbit's foot. I think that's sort of what Saul is doing here. Well, maybe if I build this altar to God, you know, he hasn't really consulted God. As a matter of fact, earlier on that day, when the priest was trying to consult God, Saul cut him off and said, we ain't got time to pray about this thing. We got to go to war. And so anyway, verse 36, Saul says, let's go get them. You know, everybody now, you got your bellies full. Let's go down by night. You remember it's evening time now. Let's go down by night and spoil them until the morning light. And don't leave a man unto them. And the people say, what you say to a king, do whatever you want to do. You're the king, right? Do whatsoever seemeth good unto thee. But then I like this. It's probably Ahijah who was mentioned earlier. The high priest at the close of verse 36 says, now hold on a minute. Let's pray about this thing. you want to take off? We've been in battle all day. We've not consulted God as we should. Saul says, I got a great idea. Let's just go down here and fight all night. So this priest says, maybe we ought to ask God's direction for this. In verse 36, the close of it, this then said the priest, let us draw near hither unto God. And Saul said, okay, sure, good. Let's ask counsel of God. Shall I go down after the Philistines without delivering them into the hand of Israel? Close of verse 37 says, but God did not answer him. Now, much could be said about this. Probably there was the casting of lots, or what is called the Urim and the Thummim, that was used in the Old Testament. It would be used by the priest to try to determine the will of God. They would essentially, and the best illustration I know to give would be something like dice, where they would roll, and whatever it said, that's what they would do. They would believe that was the determination of God. Again, Proverbs says the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole determining or determination thereof is of the Lord. So they believed in this case, yes or no, depending on what the Urim and the Thummim say or what the lots say, but they don't get an answer. They don't get a yes or a no. God has shut up the windows of heaven. And you know what? It never occurs to Saul it may be his fault. It never even occurs to him that maybe the reason God is not answering is because of your silly, selfish oath and your poor decision making. Instead, verse 38 now, let's read verse 38. And Saul said, Draw ye near hither, all the chief of the people, and know and see wherein this sin hath been this day. He assumes from this that the reason God is not answering is because somebody's done some sin. But not him. No, can't be him, obviously. Verse 39, for as the Lord liveth, which saveth Israel, though it be this sin, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. But there was not a man among all the people that answered him. Now listen, get this. The people knew the command that you weren't supposed to eat anything. and some of the soldiers had witnessed Jonathan eat the honey that had been forbidden. We're not supposed to eat anything. But nobody ratted Jonathan out. Nobody said, Saul, the problem was, the reason why God is not answering you is because your son went and ate some honey when you said nobody could eat anything. Instead, to close of verse 39, not a man among all the people answered him. Now it's interesting to me in verse 36, when Saul says, let's go to war, the people say, we'll do whatever you want. Then in verse 40, when Saul says, we're going to find out about this thing, the people say, we'll do whatever you want. But now when they're trying to find out, was Jonathan guilty in this, which is what Saul was really trying to get to, the people don't say a thing. They are really, to some degree, I think, already protecting Jonathan. Verse 40, then said he unto all Israel, be ye on one side, and I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side. And the people said unto Saul, do what seemeth good unto thee. Therefore Saul said unto the Lord God of Israel, give a perfect lot. And Saul and Jonathan were taken. Now when they cast lots, God answers. Yeah, it is either. So you got Saul and Jonathan on this side and everybody else on the other side. And when the priest cast lots, it falls on Saul and Jonathan. Verse 41, halfway through says, and Saul and Jonathan were taken, but the people escaped. Verse 42, and Saul said, cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son. And Jonathan was taken, or it was determined that it was Jonathan that had so-called broken this oath, had transgressed against the king's command. So in verse 43, then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what thou hast done. And Jonathan told him and said, I did but taste a little honey with the end of the rod that was in mine hand, and lo, I must die. And Saul answered, God do so and more also, for thou shalt surely die, Jonathan. Probably not the daddy anybody dreams of right there. Now get this. It was Jonathan that had courageously led the battle. It was Jonathan that had gone out and fought twice against a garrison of the Philistines. It was Jonathan who acted in faith to get rid of Israel's enemies. And the king, having made this silly, selfish oath, now is willing to kill his own son again because he got to save face. I can't show mercy even to my own son or else it'll make me look weak. I have said that cursed is the man that eats anything, and I am not going to show an ounce of mercy, not even to my own son. Now that tells us something about Saul. He's flighty. He's up, down. He is unpredictable. He does not give great diligent thought to his decisions. He's impetuous. He is not a strong leader. He might look good. And he's a good, to a great degree, he'll do a good job leading the army, even though this was a bad decision on this day. Overall, he's a good military leader. But I'm going to tell you something. He's got a real pride problem. A real pride problem. And Saul, verse 44, God do so more also, for thou shalt surely die, Jonathan. In verse 45, and the people said unto Saul, shall Jonathan die, who hath wrought this great salvation in Israel? God forbid. As the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he hath wrought with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, that he died not. Well, I bet that old done a lot of good for old Saul's ego, don't you? Saul says, God do so and more if Jonathan's not dead tonight. People said, you might be king, but let me tell you something. You're not going to lay a finger on Jonathan. This is interesting how the people rally together and defy the command of the king. The people gather together and say, oh no, this is not how it's going to be. And in fact, the word there for rescued at the close of verse 45, so the people rescued, is the exact same word that is often translated in the Old Testament as ransomed or redeemed. And that's pretty sweet. As ransomed or redeemed. So the people defended Jonathan, said, God forbid that a hair of his head will be harmed. So think about this. Jonathan's guilty, right? What is he guilty of? He's guilty of breaking the king's command, even if it was a silly command. And again, he was ignorant of the command. He didn't even know. But he was still guilty of breaking the law of the king. And in great sense, folks, you and I are guilty of breaking the law of the king. But the laws that we have broken are not silly and selfish laws. They are high and holy laws. They are good laws. They are righteous laws. They are moral commandments. And we've broken them. In this story, this is good, hold on. In this story, the people save the son. In our story, the son saves the people from the breaking of the law. There is some richness right here to be seen. We are guilty, but in walks grace, mercy, and forgiveness, and rescues us that we die not. In this case, old Jonathan was rescued by the nation. In our case, it is God's son that rescues us from breaking his father's law. So what happens then? In verse 46, Saul pouts all the way back home. That's just one way of saying it. But verse 46, then Saul went up from following the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. So for the time being, and that's all it will be, for the time being, there's a little peace, and it won't last long. We'll get back into this soon, because there's still a guy named Goliath that's going to show up on the scene, right? But at this story, and this is an interesting story that shows how the silly and selfish behavior of a king can affect a nation. How the silly, selfish behavior of leaders can affect a nation. Either leading them into good or pushing them towards sin. May God give us strong, godly leaders that will encourage us in good things. Whether it is nationally, I hate to say it, at a state level, because we don't even know who the next governor of Georgia is going to be, apparently. I'm going to leave that alone, leave politics out. But or whether right in a local church, may God give leaders who seek God's will and direction and not make decisions to serve their own egos. Because it just leads people away from God rather than pointing them towards God. Thank goodness that the people rescued Jonathan. And old Jonathan's going to play an important role. Still yet, he's going to become good friends with a man by the name of David real soon. Good friends. God bless you. I love you.